Now, all of you, I'm sure, can imagine if I said, do you know what a victim is? Can you feel a victim in yourself? Because a victim is something you have. We share four archetypes. Each person has a victim, a prostitute, a saboteur, and a child. Everybody has those four. And I think of those archetypes as the four archetypes of survival. Where did that come from? Well, again, I'm going to turn you back to my laboratory and say that as I did research, and I'm talking years, maybe 10, 12 years of this, those four archetypes repeatedly have come up, and they represent collectively the challenges every one of us faces to see how well we ground ourselves and whether or not we fear or feel safe with this thing called life. Those four archetypes contain our own fear of survival, and we will face lessons. We will face challenges with each one of those archetypes. Now, I want you to hold that thought and quickly jump back. I'm going to bring you back to the Masters just for a little bit, just for a visit, and show you that even the Masters encountered the prostitute, saboteur, child, victim. Quickly, Jesus was the divine child, incarnated into the divine child archetype. When we think of that child, we think of the divine child, an extraordinary archetype that absolutely came in perfectly because that archetypal form gave birth to the template of what? Something that had never existed before, the Holy Family. Never existed before. All right, hold that one. Here comes the archetype that they really challenged, which is the archetype of the prostitute. Let's see how they dealt with that one. Abraham, how did he do with the prostitute? He didn't do very good. I'll show you what he did. You know, he got stuck in, he had to flee, and he took his wife, and they fled into Egypt. And Abraham was a wealthy man, and he had slaves, and he had property, and he had animals. He had all kinds of things. He was no poor person. This guy was a wealthy little cookie. So he goes on into Egypt, and he's a frightened man. He's also a coward. He's got one of those archetypes. And he gets in there, and the Pharaoh says, like, who are you, and what are you doing, and et cetera, et cetera. And he wants to cover his backside. So you know what he does? He says to his wife, look, I'm going to tell the Pharaoh you're my sister, and you go sleep with him, and I'll be safe. The prostitute. Now, what's rich? No, pay attention. Don't you see? Get excited about this. What's so rich is that what you realize as you come into your archetypal patterns is that there's nothing heaven can't embrace. How incredibly non-judgmental the gods are. No matter which way Abraham explored the prostitute, it was okay so long as he explored the prostitute. Because as I emphasize, to do something wrong is to learn how to do it right. You cannot not learn. It's impossible. So if you said to me, Carolyn, can I fail my contract? How can you fail? Failure doesn't exist. You can decide you didn't meet your own mark, but you cannot fail. You can only learn. Whether you learn this way or that way, you can only learn. Okay, so much for Abraham. Of course, you know what happens. Eventually, there's all kinds of trouble in Egypt, and that's when the Pharaoh says, this isn't your sister, it's your wife, you creep, get out of here. And the Pharaoh decides that that's the reason why Egypt fell apart and had a famine. So anyway, so much for that. But look at Jesus. Let's go with Jesus. He's been initiated. Do you understand how exciting this is? He's been initiated. He's already gone through the high marks. He's a master. But now comes the test. And you listen carefully, because if you think you're not going to be tested again and again, I told you, I'll say it again, and I'll say it again. Every time, every single time, you can count on this. This is an archetypal pattern. You learn something about your own inner power. The first thing that happens, you'll do it even if I tell you you can't avoid it because the archetype is stronger than you are. The first thing that'll happen is you'll feel in some way arrogant, or you'll feel in some way special, or you'll feel somehow or other that you've outwitted, watch my words, you've outwitted the whimsical nature of God. You've outrun chance. Ugh, you fools. The next thing that happens is something comes out of the clear blue and tampers with your power and visits what? Your ego. So long before your new power becomes truly absorbed into your spirit, your ego is going to get a knock on the door, and this is what it looks like. We're back. We're back in Jerusalem. We're back in the desert. We're right outside Nazareth. We've left the Essene community. We've just gone through initiation. And now we're going to go into the desert. We have to fast for 40 days. How come, biblically, by the way, let me plant an archetypal question in your head. Why is everything 40 days, 40 nights? Floods, tests, think. There's a reason. There's a reason. I'll give you the answer later. I just want to make sure you keep listening. So, he has to be in the desert 40 days and 40 nights. He can't have water, can't have food. He has to go through a test of this. Now listen carefully. The test is, can you finally make your spirit stronger than your body? Can you make your inner world outrun the external world? Is your spirit strong enough to maintain life no matter what happens on the outside world? Or will you sell yourself when there's a challenge, when you're afraid, when you're weak, when you're hungry, when you're down? This is the prostitute. And the prostitute will come and test you, I'm telling you, again and again and again. The moment you become empowered, and as soon as something, even in the smallest part of your life, even in your family, even in anything, you get a raise at work, I promise you, some part of the tribe you work with, if they didn't get the raise, they'll try to negotiate some kind of power play with you. Because people don't celebrate your raise if they didn't get one. It's just not the way we work. So here comes the devil, here comes Satan. And Satan says to Jesus, I will give you every single material object on this earth if you give me that power your soul now has. I want that power, and I'll give you this power. Will you sell yourself for me? And he says, get behind me, Satan, beat it, get out of here. This looks like a test, and you think, oh, just God could do that. You don't understand. That's an archetypal test, and you have the prostitute, and I can say to you, because you have that archetype, be on the lookout. You're going to have this test. You're going to have it many times. Do you understand how rich it is to recognize that? Have you any idea if you know that? You could be in a financial crisis. Let me just reroute you for 1 second, whether it's a financial crisis or, let's say it's the opposite way. Let's say you've got barrels and gobs of money. You've got so much, it's coming out of your garage. It's here, it's there, it's falling off the roof. I know you're rolling your eyes back saying, please, God, give me that house. But anyway, let's just imagine that someone comes up to you and says, how about a business deal? And begins to talk to you about, you can make this and we could do this, and these nonsensical plans of instant wealth overnight. It's also the prostitute that alerts you to, ding, 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 this person's trying to buy my hunch. This person's trying to buy my will. This person's trying to buy my reason. The prostitute in you is an ally if you learn to sense it. That's why these things happen. So you could learn to sense when someone's after that part of your power. That part of your power. It's extraordinary. So that's why I say all of you have the prostitute, because I've seen it again and again. And all of us have the child, and all of us have the saboteur. And here the saboteur is that archetypal pattern that has a great deal to do with making you face the fears in your life that would cause you to sabotage yourself. Remember, let me put you back on track. In its most generic form, each person's contract is about empowerment and is about getting us to become as whole and integrated as we can. But at the same time, and here is an archetypal irony, you are as afraid of becoming empowered as you are being disempowered. You are terrified of becoming a whole person. You're absolutely terrified of it. Why? Because you were born knowing, and this comes in that spiritual backpack that you were given before you descended. In that spiritual backpack, you were born knowing that if you became a strong, whole being, your life is going to change. It's going to change enormously. And it's going to take down a lot of relationships that you have that are based on weakness. If you become strong, a lot of weak relationships disintegrate. If you become strong, there's a good feeling. There's a good chance, rather, that a lot in your life is going to shift gears. And many times, people are not ready for that to happen. So they sabotage opportunities that come to you in your life. So when I say you have the saboteur, I mean that every person will have experiences in which they have to confront whether or not they sabotage their own empowerment. And of course, the child we've already discussed, victim. Everybody knows what it's like to feel victimized, and you learn to stand up for yourself. Now, these four archetypes lay your groundwork as to whether or not you can manage physical survival. Can you manage taking care of yourself financially with other people? Establish boundaries. The victim and the child lay down boundaries when you finally decide, I'm not going to be victimized anymore. You go through these tests. They're universal. But then you have to collect the eight other archetypes that fill you out. And it's so much fun because I can always tell when I'm dealing with someone who's a king. I'll give you a great story. This is such a true story. I went to a Christmas party one time, and there was a man there who was at the time very successful. And he was known for being two things, successful and arrogant, but not ordinary arrogant. Courtly arrogant. And apparently he signed in one time at a hotel and he signed the king. Now the thing is, you could laugh and say, what an attitude, but that's not an attitude. That's an archetype talking. Because if you stood back and you thought, just listen to me. If you stood back and you could spot and recognize an archetype, and we'll work with this as we move forward. If you could spot an archetype, you could go step two. What is a king's pattern? You think, well, a king has to be in charge, has to rule. Okay, check. That means this person has to rule. And that this person needs a court fool. All kings do. And you start going right on down the line and describe the characteristics of a king, and you're going to find that in some way, shape, or form, they've manifested in that person. Because that's how closely aligned we are to our archetypal patterns. As I continued to do my research, it seemed like 12 seemed to be the embodiment of our own personal life contracts. And then, of course, I looked at the fact that there are 12 tribes of Israel, 12 signs of the zodiac, 12 disciples. 12 seems to be the number of completion. So it began to make a lot of sense to me. And then one day, as I was teaching this, and this was quite some time ago, and with me, the way, oftentimes the way information comes to me is that I'll be teaching and I suddenly have one of those lights go on experiences. I don't hear like bells and whistles or that kind of, you know, those experiences you hear intuitives have. Actually, I'm quite boring as an intuitive goes, you know, dull. I'm not boring, but I am dull. But anyway, I was trying to explain two things. One, I was trying to make a point that power manifests in many faces. And that, for example, the reason why cultures created many gods, like the Greeks or the Romans, and this is critical to what we're talking about, is because they sensed a bountiful nature of, shall we say, God. So much so that they wanted to name all the many aspects of power that they could grab onto. They could see that there was a fertility aspect of God, and so they decided to give it a name. They called it Demeter. And there was a hero's aspect of God. There was a part of that energy that made them feel like a warrior. There was a part of the energy that made them feel sexual. Hello, Venus, Aphrodite. They thought there was a part of that energy that made the woman feel very wise. Let's go, Sophia. They named every one of their own powers. Not only did they name this power, they built a whole mythology around it, a whole pantheon, a whole reality. They were naming the forces that were active within them. But you see, all of these forces had to be separated into individual units, because altogether, if you put all of this energy and all of this power together, your sensual power, your hero power, your intuitive power, your healing power, your goddess power, your all of this into one of our psyches, without some kind of boundaries, we would implode. We can't contain that. So when we incarnate, we take a sample of it and say, let me just work with this power, and I'll integrate these powers in my life, and then I'll be able to take on a little more, and then a little more. Just let me work with a little, and let me become integrated, and then I can take on a little more. Okay, you're with me. You know what I'm talking about. All right. So what happened is that I realized that in trying to show the integration and the separation and the organization of cosmic power, I took a look and I just drew a circle and I put in like a pie and I put in 12 slices in this pie. And I realized unconsciously I'd drawn the wheel of the zodiac, which is itself an archetype. Okay? Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the astrological wheel, it is, of course, obviously a wheel. It has 12 slices in it, and each one represents a different aspect or characteristics of your life. And just as a little bit of a background on this, astrologers have existed forever. And so this astrological wheel is itself what you would think of as an archetype. It's a template. It's recognized, and it contains, like any wheel of wisdom, like King Arthur's round table. It speaks of a structure that contains faces and phases of power that reflect and embody a whole human life. So you look at it and you can see that there's an aspect that reflects what your personal life is going to be like and what your relationships are going to be like and whether or not you're going to have children and how you're going to behave as a child and what your financial connections will be like. An astrological wheel, in short, covers every area of a human life. And what I realized was that in this circle of 12, and in duplicating the wheel of astrology, I had literally mirrored, automatically organized the power, the aspects, the many characteristics of the human being in accordance or as a reflection of what's called the houses of the zodiac. Now, by house, I mean one of those slices of pies is considered a house in the language of astrology. And in my language, I look at it as an archetypal aspect of your power. And then, of course, I began to wonder if the archetypes were matched to these houses in a very specific way. And I had to think that that was so because to date, I haven't discovered anything that's random. So I thought, well, maybe this is very specific. And what would that look like? So first, I want to explain to you, I want to give you a flavor of these houses and what's in each one of them. And then we could talk a little bit more about the archetypal construct, because truly, in order to recognize your contracts, this is the third building block you need. You want to be able to recognize your archetypal pattern, and then, well, what part of your life does it go with? I mean, if you have a victim, is there an area of your life where you're more prone to be victimized than another area? And the answer is yes. And what this does then is it gives you a real hands-on, practical way to say, here's an area of my life. What are the archetypal patterns that I'm going to be most vulnerable with or strongest in this area of my life? It gives you a beginning point, a foundation, a rich texture through which to understand the houses. And I'm going to do this fully, and I want you to do this. Let me walk you through them. I don't want you to just listen. I want you to walk. I want you to imagine yourself walking into this great big huge circle, and it's got 12 houses, just like a watch, just like a big huge pie. And you walk in the first one, and you sit in there and you think, whew, this is my house of personality. This is my house of self. This is how I feel about myself. This is how I look. This is the house where people see me first. It's about your persona. It's about how you project yourself and how other people see you in an archetypal way, not just physically. I mean, obviously, people can see that you're 5'2" or 5'9" or whatever, but they also sense you. They sense your animation. And what they pick up in your animation is your archetype and the archetypal pattern you have on the first house. So when you do an archetypal wheel, and we'll talk about what that is and how to do that, the archetype that lands in this house is the image you give to people that they see before they see you. Now come on to your second house. Your second house is, and look at the logic of life. Once you arrive and you have your ego and your persona in your first house, the next thing you're going to do is walk into your second house and you're going to say, now that I'm here, what's mine? Your second house, what's yours? It's a house of beauty, of values, of stuff, of what's important to you. And that's in this house. And so when you look at the archetypal pattern that's on this house, it's going to be directly connected to the fears, the choices, the strengths you have in terms of your relationship with the physical matter of life. Now let's go to the third house. When you get to the third house and you've already accomplished now who you are, where you are, what's yours, the third house is communication. It's how you want to express yourself. And this is a big deal house because expression is choice. Expression is power. Expression is the manner in which you conduct your spirit into matter. This is a big deal house. I've seen every kind of archetype imaginable in this house, and each one is so different. One time I saw the archetype of the vampire on this house, and this is a fun archetype to talk about. So your eyes are opening up thinking, oh my. But vampires, archetypal vampires, are very real. They're very real. A vampire archetype, and I'm going to explain this, and all of you are going to say to me, I know at least 10 of them. A vampire is someone who's got an energy that has to live off the energy of someone else in order to exist. Now, there's an aspect of the vampire that needs to be introduced here, and that's that vampires, as a rule, have a very erotic connection. They're nocturnal. They're erotic. They're bedroom characters. You don't see a vampire coming in at night into the kitchen. Think of the movies you've seen. That's not where they show up. They come in through the bedroom window, or they're invited over the threshold into the erotic zone. And that's a very important aspect of it. So that what I'm suggesting here is that if you look at vampire, a modern day psychological term for vampire is called codependent. Because that's what a codependent relationship is. There's an inability to live without each other. It's lethal on one hand, desperate on the other. That's one form of the vampire relationship. Another form is when you find that you're in a relationship with somebody or in a situation, and you know you're with a vampire when, after you've been with them, you're so exhausted you want to fall on the floor. It's as if they've sucked all the energy out of you. Now, I'm sure you know what that's like. And one vampire technique is complaining. Vampires complain. And what a vampire does when they complain is what they're really doing is they're saying, can I live off some of your optimism today? Will you give me a shot of some of your hope? Because I just can't generate it by myself. And if I don't get any hope or optimism today, I'm going to die. And after a while, you think, if I don't get away from that person, I'm going to die and I'm out of this nightclub. And the thing the vampire never wants to do is look at itself, the mirror. Because to look at itself is to suddenly have to face the light, and vampires don't want to do that. This is a very real archetype. This is a very real archetype. And it's fascinating. So to continue, let's just for fun play this out. So remember, I want you to get a feel for how absolutely on target an archetype is. And that if you have an archetypal pattern, you need to take a real good look at it, because it may be exerting more authority over you than you possibly can even begin to realize. And in keeping with that, what is becoming conscious all about but to be able to look at an archetypal pattern and take charge of yourself and release the cookie cutter, the stencil, and say, I don't need you operating in my unconscious anymore. I'm finally conscious enough to take charge of the energy that was once maneuvered by you through my unconscious. Let me say this again. When you are unconscious of your own behavior, of why you do what you do, of what your fears are, what that means is there's an archetype, there's a pattern stronger than your own conscious mind that's making choices for you. This is why I work in my workshop and I'll say, why are you doing that? And so many people will say, I don't know. And I won't let them get away with it. I'll push them harder and I'll say, what do you mean you don't know? You're too old not to know yourself. You're too old. Now push yourself into your unconscious and don't let yourself get away with something as five-year-oldish as I don't know. And I push them until they will say, I have a fear of, or I really am jealous of. And they begin to pull this pattern out from the behind their unconscious. Because once it's out, that pattern cannot control you like a puppet on a string anymore. Okay, so let's keep going. Fourth house. The fourth house of the astrological, or what I now call the archetypal wheel, is home. The archetype that lands in this house has the closest patterns to what your home life is like. Both the home you grew up in, the home you're in, it has that kind of feel to it. Now let's go to the fifth house. The fifth house is the house of children. It's the house of sexual affairs. It's the house of luck. It's the house of benevolence. It's the house of what you want to think of as indulgence. It's just the playhouse of the chart. That's the only way to put it. So it's fun. It's a wonderful house. And it's a great thing to see what archetype you land on here. It's just great fun. The sixth house is your house of health and your house of occupation. I find that to be a very interesting match because of how many times people will say, my job makes me sick. And they don't realize what an archetypal statement they've just made. They are unconsciously, automatically connecting two forces that go together in one house. And there is a relationship between what you do and how you feel and how you use your energy. All right. The seventh house, this is your house of relationships and partnerships. So it's not just marriage, it's all partnerships. It's one-on-one partnerships. All right. The eighth house is the house of legal matters, of inheritance, of death, of rebirth. Now I want to talk about this one for a minute because I want to expand your mind in a kind of an interesting way here. And this is also the house of what I would call DNA patterns and the patterns you inherit from your family biologically. It's also the house of the inheritance of psychic and emotional patterns and of karmic patterns. All right. So this is the house of inheritance, no matter how large you define it. And when someone says, you know that archetypal expression, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree? That expression absolutely reflects that there is an inheritance factor. And the inheritance is not that the apple is going to be a duplicate of the apple tree. We know that if you hear that expression, do you assume that it's characteristics that are being inherited or shoe size? Characteristics. And yet, think about that. That expression does not say the shoe size doesn't fall far from the tree or their emotional characteristics. We assume that we are talking about psyches don't fall far from the older generation. Psyches, souls, somehow or other, we hand down certain traits. Just like the sins of the father are visited upon the child. Somehow we have recognized archetypally that there is a DNA inheritance that, to put this in huge archetypal language, that we, every generation after another, inherit unfinished patterns, evolutionary patterns that have to be continued from the generation before, that need to be worked through and resolved and woven into our own individual lives. Therefore, you're not just living for yourself, you're living for countless others through you. And that's a phenomenal, phenomenal thought. The archetype that falls into this house is the one that illustrates or reflects the type of power issues and empowerment characteristics you have in that area of your life. It's very interesting when you see somebody who has a warrior there, or a very strong monk or a nun, the qualities people bring to this journey of how they carry through the energetic patterns that are larger than themselves. It's just fascinating. Let's move on. The ninth house is your house of spirituality. And it's, of course, your house not just of spirituality in terms of do you meditate, you a Buddhist, you this, Catholic, Christian, whatever. When you think of spirituality, think about the whole of how you relate to the spirit entirely. Think about how you see your spirit as a force outside of spirituality. Do you ever give your spirit attention as the verb of your life, as just the creative portion of your life, or do you and can you only think of it within spiritual terms? Do you ever just think about it as this neutral creative entity? It's very interesting if you listen to people speak. They do speak about their spirit as a separate entity other than themselves. My spirit is sad. Well, then who are you? I mean, who are you? If your spirit's sad, are you happy? What? What's going on here? I don't get it. Are you spirit phrenic? I mean, what are you talking to me about? You know, you and your spirit are one, but by that very sentence, you're saying you're not. Isn't that intriguing? You never thought about it, have you? See? Caught you. But this is the house where you engage in thoughts about the spiritual nature of life, the unconscious nature of life. This is that house. Your 10th house is your highest potential. Now, this is worth chatting about in terms of the whole of a contract and everything we're discussing. This is a great big huge house. What's your highest potential mean? Now, if I asked you to do that like an exam, like all of you, write down your highest potential and send it to me, 90% of it would be vague and meaningless answers. Highest potential is to find something that makes me real happy. That's always fun. Here's another one. Highest potential, to become peaceful. What does that mean? To become happy? Get out of here. To become fulfilled. What? You give me vague, meaningless, useless, evaporative words. What is highest potential? You know what it is? This is what is true. Your highest potential is to act, choose in every moment where you recognize a choice is present, its highest possible outcome. Let me say this again. Your highest potential is a bite-sized, grainy thing. It isn't one great big huge thing. And all of the grains eventually make a great big huge castle in the sand. Every choice you make has a polar opposite. You can choose negative, you could choose light, dark, light, dark, light. In every moment, you could choose the highest potential possible that you see in a circumstance. That's your highest potential. It's not one thing. It's a configuration of how you manage power in every single situation. The better way to think of it is, can you manage the highest potentials of your life? Put an S on that word. Put an S on it. It's your highest potentials. You just don't have one. What is one? If I let you get away with that word, you will think it's a job. And if I whack you left, right, and center and scream it's not a job, you'll still think it's a job. And you'll still say, but you didn't tell me what my job is. You have to stop defining your life in terms of an occupation. It means your life is worthless after 8 hours. It means everybody who isn't working has no spiritual purpose in life. You've got to stop that. Your life is not a job. What you do in terms of occupation or job is a reflection of what serves the integration of your spirit. And for that reason, no matter what you do, whether you're the CEO of a company or running the most wonderful magazine or this, that, and the other, it holds an extremely high potential of contributing to the process of human transformation. How do you know who's going to be picking up your quilt and thinking, this is so wonderful, and that triggers from something else? And you have no idea how the network of life is laid out. None whatsoever. You haven't got a clue. But if you were to take a clue, if I were to lead you into the archetypal library where clues are found and mysteries decoded, I would sit all of you down and I would say, listen, I want to show you something. Why do you think someone like, oh, let's pick someone out of the hat, why do you think a teacher like, oh, I don't know, maybe someone named Jesus was born in a manger? What does that have to do with anything? Now, of course, historically, at the literal level, it has been suggested that the manger was the name of the nursery where all of the women who were part of the Essenes had their babies. Having said that, there is also a symbolic meaning. This is another point. Everything in your life, literally, I want you to take whoosh, to the symbolic world. Literal, you're just going to go nuts. Symbolically, you're going to get into clarity. At the symbolic level, it means this, that power comes in humble packages. Power comes in humble packages. God sends power in on the backs of fools and little children. Always, always, always. Because they look harmless. The most harmless task in your life could be the most powerful. Sometimes it comes in a very harmless package to save you from an ego confrontation. To save you from getting out of control. Sometimes it's to protect what you're doing from the energy of other people. Sometimes the most powerful thing you do needs protection so that no one else comes at it with negative thoughts. So it looks harmless or it looks foolish. You have no idea. But the highest potential means that you, like in a contract, accept that this is something you have to do. You don't know why. But it's not for you to say that what you're doing in any given moment is worthless because you don't really know the reason. And so the greatest choice you can make is to decide, I'm going to bless it. I don't know what I'm doing here, but I'm going to bless it and let the gods work through me in whatever way they need. That's how to live the highest potential of a contract. Now, does that make sense to you? All right. Let's keep going. We're in the 11th house. In the 11th house, it's how you see the world. It's how you look at the world. You know how some people see the world optimistically or pessimistically, and they develop ideas of reality. No, don't be silly. God would never do this, or it's like that, or things would never be this way, or don't be silly. Life has to be all bountiful and all wonderful, etc. Whatever ideas you have about reality will live, exist within the energy field of this house. All right, let's move into the 12th house. The 12th house is the house of your unconscious. It's the house of secrets. It's the house of dreams. That's a fabulous, fascinating house because the dreams, your dreams, will tend to expand and open up, speak to you all the more when you start to work with your archetypes. Why? Because you've given them a language. That's what's so incredibly rich about pursuing yourself to this depth. Because when you start to think about yourself in terms of, well, you know what? I really have been working with the judge archetype all my life, or I've been working with this, or I can see where I have a serious networker archetype, or whichever one you pick. Listen, you give your psyche a language, a word, a means to reach you that you didn't have before. Your 12th house is your dreams, your dream house. It's that rich, unconscious place. It also represents your unconscious fears. It represents parts of yourself that you have yet
now
to
I've
learn.
Given you the third building block of this particular program on sacred contracts. The first one, of course, was to introduce you to the guides of necessity, choice, and compassion, and how you coordinated your sacred contract, how you pulled it together, and how you prepared to descend into physical life. The second is to introduce you to the lives of the masters, and how their lives were templates for the expansion of the spirit in the process of awakening, and in fact, richly, to the way heaven pursues you so that you will awaken. And now I've introduced you to archetypes and this structure called the archetypal wheel. Well, what are you going to do with all of them? We're going to put them together. And in putting them together, now you get a complex, moving, rich lens, like a mandala, through which to understand yourself physically, emotionally, psychologically, and archetypally. You are that complex. And as I said, it's time for you to learn how to actually utilize this material and feel its guidance. That's where we're going to move next. But wait 1 minute. We're going to end with a little bit of a, what did I mean by 40 days? What's the significance of this pattern? Well, there are people who believe, and now we're sort of in the area of folklore, mythology, that would suggest that 40 days is the incubation period through which the spirit manages to become stronger than the physical world. Or to say it differently, it's the maximum in initiation that the spirit can move, can endure, to finally beat the restraints or the limitations of the physical world. 40 days is considered the time zone of initiation. Now, whether or not they mean 40 literal days, whether or not they mean 40 mythic days, 40 astrological days, who knows? But it's considered the length of time, mythically, folklore, or symbolically, of the process of initiation. So let's use that just for fun. Let's imagine that you had a really deep and rich question, and you wanted to have a revelation, not an answer, but a revelation. That's a different thing. A revelation is more like asking for a true epiphany, a true changing. The thing about a revelation is you have to be able to act on it. You can't ask for that quality of data and then just shrug it off. Believe me, you can't do that. So if you said, I really want some guidance on how to move forward with my spiritual life, what am I supposed to do? What do you want from me next? You don't have to be asking out of sorrow. You could be asking out of the place that says, I'm ready. I really am ready to serve life in a different way. Show me what you want. Reveal it to me. Write that in a prayer. Write that as a request. And put it away for 40 days. And literally say, I am doing this in the belief that 40 days is a period of my incubation. I'm not going to pray about it again. I'm not going to think about it. I did. I put it away. I'm putting it in your hands for incubation. And I'll await the answer in 40 days. And I am going to assume, let me add something. Let me pull you in so that you start thinking and using contracts. That between now and then, things that happen, frighten, anything that rocks your boat, you are going to look at as an integral part of the answer to that question. You're going to see it as a contract. Not as an interference, not as a nuisance, not as luck, but as part of the groundwork for the answer to that request, to that revelation. All right? It's contract time.
This concludes Session 3 of Sacred Contracts with Carolyn Mace. Our program continues with Session 4.